Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is On Air Daily News for Monday, April 24th, 2024. I'm Naima Latif. And today we are joining a live White House press conference on the war in Sudan. The conflict has had an impact, and the White House is issuing its response as National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan clarifies the U.S. position and its involvement in the conflict in Sudan, as well as the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. Fighting in Sudan between forces loyal to two rival generals has triggered a mass exodus of foreigners while locals struggle to escape. A number of countries, including the United States, the United Kingdom, Sweden, Spain, the Netherlands, Japan, Italy, Germany, France, and Canada, airlifted and evacuated diplomats, embassy staff, and others from Sudan's war-torn capital over the weekend. Both the United States and Canadian governments also announced temporary suspensions of operations at their embassies in Khartoum. An estimated 16,000 Americans, most of whom are dual U.S. Sudanese citizens, remain in Sudan, according to John Kirby, coordinator for strategic communications at the National Security Council at the White House. John Kirby told ABC News anchor George Stephanopoulos in an interview on Monday on Good Morning America. He said, "These are people that grew up in Sudan, work in Sudan, families are in Sudan, and they want to stay in Sudan. So it's a number that is difficult to plan to specifically." Well, there are also several dozen Americans currently making their way to Sudan's main seaport via a United Nations-led convoy, which the U.S. is monitoring via, quote, intelligence. And surveillance and reconnaissance assets to ensure their safety. We still have military forces pre-positioned in the region ready to respond if need be. But right now, it's not very safe to try to run some larger evacuation either out of the nearby air base or even just through rotary lift like we did the other night because the fighting is so intense, he added. The safest things for Americans to do, those who have decided to stay in Sudan despite the warning to leave, is to shelter in place and to not move around too much in the city of Khartoum. And now we're going to join a White House press briefing by National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. And we will certainly look forward to updates and this ongoing crisis in Sudan. And here we are at the White House for this press briefing. And we'll look forward to continuing information from National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. Let's join them now.
Both about the risks and about the available options to them. And we will continue to stay in close communication with those Americans who we have contact information from. And the State Department is doing that on a day-to-day basis. In some cases, on an hour-to-hour basis, we remain available to any American in Sudan who is looking for support and guidance from the U.S.
And can you provide any updates on even the hope or possibility of a ceasefire, where negotiations stand, and the U.S.
comments from the State Department and from our ambassador on the ground, who was in daily contact until he was pulled out, but will remain working the phones from his position now outside of the country. I don't want to speculate about what will or won't happen because it's a very dynamic situation, but we have not given up on the notion that there could be a ceasefire that comes into effect and is durable. There was a ceasefire in place during a portion of the Eid holiday. There is, as we speak now, efforts by both sides to have a diminution in violence. There is a goal to continue extending that beyond the end of the Eid period, and we will keep working with close partners in pushing the two sides to try to deepen and extend the diminution in violence that we have seen and to try to get a permanent durable ceasefire in place. I can't give you a prediction as to whether that is likely to be successful or unsuccessful. We see the risk of protracted conflict here, but we also see a possibility, one that we are going to exercise every tool we have available to us, that we could get to a ceasefire, and we want to drive to that if at all possible. Yes.
What more can you tell us about the contours of the nuclear deterrence package that you announced this week? Is it to be viewed in the context of the desire on the part of the majority of the people in South Korea to base out their own nuclear deterrence?
We will have the two presidents, actually release a statement that deals with the question of extended deterrence, particularly in the context of the threat and the evolving threat posed by the DPRK. I'm going to wait until we roll out that statement. I won't preview it in great detail from this podium, but what I will say is that we believe that that statement sends a very clear and demonstrable signal of the United States' credibility when it comes to its extended deterrence commitments to the Republic of Korea and to the people of Korea. And we also believe that the ROK has been a good steward of its non-proliferation obligations under the NPT and will continue to do so.
Yeah. Thanks, Jake. One of the early kind of themes of the message of the administration was foreign policy for the middle class. I was just wanted to ask, is that still a driving theme, and is it now harder to achieve considering the increasing challenges around the world? What's going on now in Sudan, pardon me, as well as Ukraine?
So, you know, I've heard some voices saying, for example, we shouldn't support Ukraine because we have to be focused at home. And my answer to that is the same answer the Democratic and Republican presidents have given over the course of decades, which is we're the United States of America. We can and must do both. We can look after our people at home and make far-reaching investments in the middle class here through good-paying jobs for years and decades to come, while also standing up for the values that we hold dear around the world, including the value of freedom and freedom for the people of Ukraine. We are capable of doing both, and that's not an abstract proposition. That is the last year since the war broke out. In that time, we have not only mobilized an international coalition to resist Russian aggression and to protect Ukraine as a sovereign and independent country, we have also made historic investments in clean energy, in infrastructure, in technology, in the United States, investing in this country in ways that are going to make the middle class stronger, more vibrant, and bigger than it was when President Biden took office. So from my perspective, the United States has significant obligations around the world, obligations that relate directly to our national security and to the well-being of working people here in this country. We will discharge those obligations. We will do that while at the same time putting in place the most significant set of investments in more than a generation in working people, middle-class people in the United States. And so I think the results speak for themselves. And the answer is yes, we still are committed to a foreign policy for the middle class.
Yeah, thanks, Jake. You said from the podium that the U.S. government has been telling Americans not to go to Sudan for more than a decade, not to send them there to leave. Obviously, that message has had limited impact for their thousands of Americans who were living in Sudan when this fight broke out. Is there more that needs to be done for Americans in countries where you think they should not be to drive home that message in a more direct way so that they're not in harm's way when danger erupts?
Look, Americans are free people. We cannot dictate where they travel, tell them they must go or not go to a particular place. We can only give them the best, clearest, most sustained, most consistent advice. And we have been as clear, as consistent, and as sustained as we possibly can over the course, not just of this administration, but previous administrations, to tell people about the dangers of living in Sudan. I would also point out that the American people do need to understand, as I've stood at this podium and said in other contexts, like in Ukraine, it is not standard practice for the United States to send in the U.S. military into war zones to extract all American citizens. We didn't do it in Libya, we didn't do it in Syria, we didn't do it in Yemen, and no, we didn't do it in Ukraine. Afghanistan was a unique case involving the end of a 20-year war that the United States was centrally involved in, but Americans should understand that we will go to great lengths to support and facilitate their departure from difficult circumstances, that we will try to protect them from harm as best as we possibly can, but that there should not be a broad expectation of a massive military operation to seize an airport or otherwise evacuate people from a country. And that has been the pattern over the course of many years. It is the exception, not the rule, for us to do something like that.
So when it comes to those great lengths you just mentioned, Kirby this morning said that right now, it's not very safe to try and run some larger evacuation, but should we take that to mean that there is a willingness to conduct a larger scale evacuation if and when conditions improve?
Well, there's certainly a willingness to take steps to help Americans be able to get out of the country, and if those steps in a risk analysis included, potentially facilitating civilian flights or anything else along those lines, the president has asked for every conceivable option to be able to help Americans. We would like to help as many Americans go as possible, but we want to be able to do so in a way that is fundamentally reducing overall risk, not increasing overall risk. That's the calculus that we're making on a day-to-day basis. And right now, we believe that the best way for us to help facilitate people's departure is, in fact, to support this land evacuation route, as well as work with allies and partners who are working on their own evacuation plans as well. Combination of three things. One, the opportunity presented itself because it became clear to us that this was a viable operation, that we could run it, we could do it, and so he thought, okay, you've given me an option that will be successful. Second, it became clear also that there was a decent likelihood that we would see some form of protracted conflict, even if punctuated by moments of ceasefire, and so we couldn't just wait for the end of this all. And then third and finally, there were considerations, which I won't go into great detail here, involving how long you can sustain a platform with a full complement of U.S. personnel living at an embassy indefinitely while fighting is raging and supplies are difficult to obtain. So you put all of those things together, the president felt this was the right moment, it was the right opportunity. He directed his military to seize that opportunity, and they successfully carried out the mission.
Thank you, Jake. On Ukraine, I wanted to give you the opportunity to respond to a former White House stenographer who this month outed you as an anonymous senior administration official who briefed reporters on Air Force 2 en route to Ukraine in 2014. He said that you spoke about giving aid to the Ukrainian national gas industry just days after the first or the second son had secretly joined the board of a Ukrainian gas company. He says he considers you part of a corrupt influence peddling conspiracy. He wants to testify to a Delaware grand jury about it. Do you have a response to that? And were you part of a corrupt influence peddling operation involving the Biden family in Ukraine or any other country?
No.
Thank you so much, Jake. Two questions. One about the conversation I had with your counterpart from Brazil about the comments, Lula comments on the war in Ukraine. Do you believe that conversation put the episode behind smoothing the situation, and today Brazil condemned the violation of Ukraine territorial integrity at the UN Security Council? So right now, do you have confidence you can count on Brazil on the matter? Then I have another question about the litigation going to Colombia.
Good conversation with my Brazilian counterpart, Ambassador Amarin. We covered a wide range of issues, including Ukraine. and including some of the public comments that we had seen. It was constructive. It was detailed. We agreed we were going to follow up and have a further, longer strategic conversation about the full range of issues that the U.S. and Brazil both face around the world, and I'll leave it at that for now. But I do have confidence in the fundamental underlying strength of the U.S.-Brazil relationship. It is a relationship of two great democracies, two peoples who are dynamic and innovative, and there's a lot of good work we can do together, including, for example, in protecting the Amazon. And President Biden just made a significant announcement of U.S. support for a Brazilian initiative to be able to protect the Amazon. That's the kind of thing that we should build on, even as we take on these difficult geopolitical challenges together. So,
We're both on the same line.
Yeah, go for it and then.
Is the question of South Korea contributing to Ukrainian ammunition supplies going to be part of the something they'll discuss, whether that's via the U.S. or directly to Ukraine? Thank you.
Well, I will disappoint you by saying that I'm not going to get into the private conversations that they will have about Ukraine. Obviously, Ukraine is going to be an important topic of conversation. The president will thank President Yoon for the $230 million in non-lethal assistance they have given, the support on sanctions and export controls, and then they will have a chance to talk about the military situation on the ground there. But I'm not going to go further or get ahead of the president in terms of that conversation that will take place when President Yoon and he meet here at the White House on Wednesday. Yeah, I'll take the, and then I'll call it a day.
Thank you, Jack. I appreciate calling in to you on the 70th anniversary of the U.S. and South Korea alliance. And the South Korean people are excited about what gift President Yoon will bring from this summit. So what, you know, would be the surprising agreement between
I told you about the surprising agreement, then it wouldn't be a surprise anymore. So, no, I don't. Look, actually, I don't. We're not going to spring something on the world or on the American people or on the Korean people. I think the Korean and the American people are expecting to see a summit in which there are tangible deliverables in the security space, and we will have deliverables related to extended deterrence in the economic space, and there will be announcements of significant investments in the people-to-people space, and you will see announcements in that regard as well. And then they expect the two presidents to cover issues related to the big topics of the day, from the war in Ukraine to the climate crisis. And so I think this summit is going to meet the very high expectations that both publics have from it, and they're right to have high expectations because we are reaching a new level in strength of the US-ROK alliance. I think that will be on full display when President Yoon is here on Wednesday, and we are very much looking forward to laying out the full suite of achievements and outcomes from this summit on Wednesday, and I will not further steal the thunder from the president, either this president or the ROK president, before doing that on Wednesday.
Russia mentioned possibility of sending more than 10,000 North Korean troops to the Donbas. How can you think about this? North Korea's troops, special forces to Donbas, Ukraine. So how are you going to think about this?
I mean, our position is that there should not be Russian forces on sovereign Ukrainian territory, and there shouldn't be forces of any other hostile country on sovereign Ukrainian territory either, and that position is clear and unequivocal, shared between the U.S., the ROK, and every country that has voted to condemn this brutal, illegal war of aggression being perpetrated by Russia against Ukraine. Thank you, guys.
Why did they argue and bring you undetected for so long?
I think the pool has to gather. Oh, it's open press. Okay. All right. Well, I guess you guys can go gather if you choose to do.
Real quick, did the president get under some calls to now sit down with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, now that he has released his outline for his plan on the debt limit? Why is now the time for the president actually speak to the Speaker and begin substantive negotiations?
So here's the thing. Look, we've been very clear. We're not going to negotiate over avoiding default. We've been very clear about that. The administration is going to have a conversation with leaders over the budget, over the spending cuts. We've been very clear about that. We have said that from the beginning of this process, that, look, we'll have that conversation. But when it comes to default, when it comes to their constitutional duty, that is something that they can do today. They can actually deal with something that would be devastating if they didn't take action, right? Now, when it comes to what we have seen them put forward, 22% cut on education, on veterans, on Meals on Wheels, on food safety, on law enforcement, all of those things are devastating to working families, and clearly they showed us what their value were. But what they have done is they have put those two things together, debt ceiling and spending cuts, and we have always been very clear, Zeke. We have been very, very clear. We are not going to negotiate when it comes to the full faith and credit of this nation, and they are holding that hostage currently. They are holding the economy hostage, and so, look, they have to, we're not negotiating over that, and they have to avoid default. It's very clear. It's very clear. They need to make sure that we're not put in a situation where our economy could put it at risk. And again, been very clear about that. I think we have to. Yeah, you have to leave now if you want to cover, and I'll go for another. I think once he starts speaking, we have to end. So I'll go for a couple more minutes. Go ahead.
Thank you, Queen. We saw the Mr. Stone decision, and so I wanted to, since we saw the statement from the President, of course, over the weekend as well. Just going forward, as that case makes its way through the court, what more can we expect to see from the White House and from the President, of course, the VP?
So look, the one thing that really want to make sure that that the American people understand that MIFA Prestone is very much remains available while we continue the fight in courts. And that's what we're committed to do. We've said this over and over again. This administration, the Biden-Harris administration, is going to continue to fight for women's rights. We're going to continue to fight for the FDA to have the right to make these medical decisions, to make these evidence-based decisions. And so that's what we saw. That's what the judgment preventing the lower cut decision from going into effect, which is incredibly important. But we are going to continue to fight, and we're going to continue to call on Congress to codify Roe. And that is something that you heard, that you saw in the President's statement, that is something that you've heard from the President many times. Again, the fight continues. We're going to continue to fight for millions of women who are across the country, and that will not stop.
Just a specific question on that. A lot of retail pharmacy chains around the country are going through this certification process to keep retail available, or even in some situations, make them available for the first time. Can you give us an update on where things stand? Is the White House working with HHS? Because that regulatory change was proposed in January. Is there any update on that?
That is something that HHS can speak to much more directly. What I can say from here is that we believe that we will prevail in the courts. We believe that the law is on our side, and we're going to continue to fight for millions of women across the country. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, thanks, Karine. I'm going to follow up on what Zeke asked there. Senator Klobuchar on CNN yesterday said that President Biden should sit down and negotiate with the Speaker on the budget, but also made clear that the spending cuts should not be tied to the debt ceiling. And so would President Biden sit down with McCarthy to debate, to negotiate their different budget proposals, or what is the position?
I want to be very clear here. The House Republicans' position is, unless the President and the Senate agree to their entire agenda, that they're going to default and crash the economy. And that is dangerous. That is something that we're going to continue to call out, and it is unreasonable to do. We have been very clear. There will not be any negotiation around the debt ceiling, right? This is something that is their constitutional duty to do. They've done it three times. You've heard me say it over and over again. They did it three times in the last administration, and they should do it now. And look, you know, every Republican that votes for this bill that Speaker McCarthy and MAGA Republicans have put forth, they're voting for cutting costs on veterans. They're voting for cutting costs on education. I just laid out at the top of the briefing what that would mean. 60,000, I mentioned 60,000 teachers. I mentioned how many kids it would affect. And so that's what they would be voting for, against those things that American families need. And we're talking about programs that they need to meet ends meet. And so we've been very, very clear. It is unreasonable to put forth what they did last week. It is cruel. That piece of legislation is cruel. And so they need to really make sure that we don't go into default. And that's what they're asking to do. They're asking to hold our economy hostage and go into default. And that's something that we're going to continue to call out.
Now, last week, you didn't seem to rule out the possibility, though, of President Biden sitting down with McCarthy at some point. Is that something you're open to?
So, look, again, House Republicans must avoid default. Been very clear. And that is within their power to do at any moment. That is within their power to do at any moment. And so that's what we're expecting them to see. I think I have to wrap it up super quick, guys. Go ahead.
In the Ralph Yarl shooting in Kansas City, local leaders are calling on the DOJ to step in and pursue hate crime charges. Is that something that the White House would support?
I'm not going to get ahead of the DOJ. That's something that they need to decide. We've been very clear about Ralph Yarl. As you know, the president spoke to him and his family last week to wish him a speedy recovery. And we've been very clear on how we see moving forward when it comes to gun violence and Congress to do more, Republicans in Congress to do more. Trying to protect families and communities across the country. That's the action that this president has taken the last 2 years, doing more, almost two dozen actions and executive orders to make sure that we are taking steps to stop an epidemic that we're seeing with gun violence. And that's what he should do as president. Now we ask the House Republicans to do the same, to have some courage so we can protect our families and protect our kids. Thanks, everybody. I'll see you tomorrow.
And that was the White House briefing. First, we heard from National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan as he gives more information on the U.S. position on its involvement in evacuating people from Sudan, and also the position that the United States is taking in support for Ukraine. Also, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre further elaborated on efforts that the White House is making to address the issues of gun violence across the United States and legislation that is being urged by both the Senate and the House to effectively create some type of safety for American families. You've been listening to On Air Daily News. Join us tomorrow, again, bringing you information coming from the White House, from your state house, and from your local city government, keeping you informed of the latest in policies and legal actions taken by your elected officials. Feel free to call us at 515-605-9749 to report your good news, and we'll gladly share it with our listening audience. I'm Naima Latif. And we'll be back tomorrow. Hear us Monday through Friday, 1 p.m. Central, 2 p.m. Eastern, at www.blogtalkradio.com/onairdailynews. Until tomorrow, enjoy the rest of your day.